Paperback Writer.
Good morning and welcome to the first ever Pighog radio show. I'm Meredith Collins, editor of Brighton-based indie publishing house Pighog. For those of you who are unfamiliar with Pighog, we are an award-winning publisher creating groundbreaking experiences of the written and spoken word. This show will be bringing readings from local Pighog poets and authors, as well as interview segments with the writers themselves. We'll also be showcasing events in the Brighton area that feature Pighog, poetry open mics, workshops and all other sorts of goodies for those of you listening who are partial to a bit of poetry. On the show this morning, I'll be joined by Paul Hoggart, author of the new and exciting Brighton-published thriller A Man Against a Background of Flames, which launched this past week in Brighton. The Times calls it an amazing story, and Richard Caulfield of the Oxford Mail says, "Move over, Dan Brown." There is also a terrific review in this week's issue of The Tablet saying, "It's extremely refreshing to read a novel which encompasses this wide range of tone and characterization with such a densely plotted, violent and breath-stoppingly exciting story." To give you an idea of the storyline, in the opening pages, the story reveals James Appleby is about to become involved in an exciting discovery that takes place in Amsterdam. An old colleague of Appleby's has come across a chest of ancient documents which may reveal secrets long sought after. As the quick-firing plot draws the reader in, it becomes clear this discovery will ignite a global firestorm with the power to engulf all Appleby loves.
Okay, this extract is taken from the middle of the book, and in it, the hero, James Appleby, is being hunted by a sort of manic American assassin who has come to the home of a police officer who's part of Appleby's protection detail. And the situation is that he has tied up this man's wife and children, and the man's come home to find this, and he's holding a gun to him, and they get into a conversation about why he's hunting Appleby. So here goes. "What do you want him for, anyway?" said Gen V. "He's just a historian. He's completely harmless. What's he done to you?" "Just a historian?" The man gave a sarcastic snort. "That's just the kind of a response I would expect from an Englishman. You are a weak, decadent nation who turned your backs on God many, many years ago, including those of you who still pretend to be Christians. Even your clergy rarely accept the literal truth of the Bible. You tolerate or actively encourage the abomination of homosexuality, which is expressly prohibited by the laws of God, along with abortion and every other form of sin and depravity. Your historian, sir, is an enemy of Christ. So you want to kill him for being English and tolerating gays? Is that what you're saying?" The man gave a sigh of frustration. "I have no desire to get involved in some pointless theological debate with you, Sergeant, nor do I propose to do so. But I will say this. The twin viruses of atheism and agnosticism have been spreading across the United States for many decades now, polluting the spiritual waters and placing the immortal souls of the weak and gullible in peril of eternal damnation and the fires of hell. But this creature, whom you and your colleagues are currently protecting, is the source of something much more deadly than the sickness of so-called honest doubt. The belief system he has introduced is an aggressive, metastasizing cancer spreading through the tissues of my country, destroying healthy flesh and organs. And it does so by the most treacherous possible means, by mimicking the joy and bliss of worship, which is mankind's route to know his Saviour, and turning it into a hollow parody. Your harmless historian, Sergeant Genvy, is a malignant tumour, and I am the Lord's scalpel.
Thank you, Paul. That was a reading from A Man Against a Background of Flames, presented by author Paul Hoggart. Joining me now is the author himself, speaking about his inspiration for the novel and the intriguing development of the story's endearing protagonist, Professor James Appleby. Paul, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about where the inspiration for the story came from, based on the historical content and religious themes presented throughout.
Well, the initial impulse was rather almost a joke, really, in my head, because I'd been thinking of writing a novel for some time, and I wanted it to have a historical dimension. But I'd been thinking about the Da Vinci Code and how annoying it was that Dan Brown had gained the frisson of his book by claiming it was based on historical facts, when in fact it was based on a series of historical propositions which have been comprehensively proved to be fraudulent, and he must have known that, and it annoyed me. But I was thinking about how people love historical mysteries, and I thought, what if you had a mystery where the secret turned out to be something much more almost pathetic, almost humdrum, but which nevertheless had a sort of relation to modern life. And so I sort of lighted on the late 16th century, because it was a time of enormous philosophical and religious change. And the more I started researching it, that period, the more fascinated I got with it, and with a sort of religious background. So that's how the sort of mystery element in the story came about.
Right, okay. And James Appleby then is quite an amusing character throughout the novel. At times seems to find himself in predicaments, particularly with regards to his love life, yet he doesn't come across as a great Lothario, so to speak. What were your ideas in presenting him as this mediocre professor who seems to get quite a lot wrong in his personal life?
Yes, I suppose he does, but then don't we all? I mean, I think the word mediocre is a little bit harsh, because he's actually quite hard-working in a slightly lackadaisical sort of way. And he, you know, he's a specialist in a very rather limited area, which a lot of people might not find that interesting, but he is an expert and he's a bit of an authority. But he's one of these people, and I think there are a lot of them in life, who somehow miss the main chance, or get bypassed and overtaken by people who are not necessarily any better than they are at what they do. In fact, they may often be rather worse. And I think there's a lot of James Appleby's about, and they're kind of people who tend to be genially resigned to not quite having established everything they'd like to in life, and feeling slightly disappointed, but sort of have come to terms with it in a kind of way. His love life is a slightly different matter, because after a sort of shaky start, he's found a woman he's deeply happy with, even though she doesn't on the face of it appear to be his type at first. And they have a very happy marriage, but things start going wrong for reasons which are completely beyond his control. And he ends up finding himself in a marriage which is sort of dying on its feet, and seeks consolation elsewhere when it's sort of thrown at him. But he doesn't go out looking for affairs. They rather tend to come to him. So he's not really a Lothario, although there's quite a lot of different love interests in the novel. But he's just somebody who's had a bit of bad luck, and some women are nice to him along the way.
And he's very genuine in that sense. The relationships in the novel are incredibly genuine because of the realistic quality of them. And they exist alongside a significant shift in time between the Elizabethan era of the novel and the protagonist's present day. Without giving too much away, I wonder if you might be able to tell us a bit about the story's integral historical character, Sir Nicholas Harker.
Well, it's not giving too much away to say that what Appleby discovers is the existence of a suppressed cult. And this cult has been created by a late 16th century landowner called Sir Nicholas Harker. And we see quite a bit of Harker's writings, actually, during the course of the novel. Harker is an exceptional character because he has retreated to his family estate in the country. He's a scholar whose scholarship from his early days at Oxford University has branched out to make him an expert in not just ancient Christian theology, but he's become interested in other world religions. And he has he's managed to amass a unique collection of religious texts from around the world. But studying comparative religion has given him what for the time would have been a very peculiar and we would think a very advanced view of religion. The way he starts a sect is almost accidental because he's this slightly reclusive scholar living in his family home in the middle of an estate, but he's incredibly committed to the villagers and to the people on his estate, and he's beloved and he's trusted by them, and they go to him for advice quite early in his story, and he starts inviting them to his home, and it's really out of groups where the villagers have assembled for discussions that Harker begins to kind of deploy his own relatively modern thinking into his discussions with them, and gradually over the decades this turns into something much more serious and something which the church regards as profoundly threatening. So that's really what that story is all about.
Right, and so the concept then of this ceremonial humanism, it becomes such a global movement in the novel, and is perhaps similar to what's happening currently with the Sunday assemblies. It's quite a remarkable parallel to the book, isn't it?
Well, I must say I was rather gobsmacked because I've been working on this book over quite a long period of time with a big interruption in the middle, but I was working on the umpteenth re-edit when I read pieces in the papers about the Sunday Assembly, I thought, oh my God, this is happening in real life. I mean, I've got Harker's ceremonies being taken up and run with and creating a sort of global cult in the modern world, but here are some people who actually seem to be having quite a bit of success starting a kind of atheist or at least non-believers form of communal, well, you can't call it worship, but it's something that parallels the experience of being in church and being part of a community and singing along together and thinking together and listening to talks together. Of course, the only difference is that in my book, this cult is all done in the language of William Shakespeare and the King James Bible, or at least my attempt at reproducing something like that, whereas in real life it's done to the words of songs by Queen and Meatloaf.
Yes, a slight difference. Well, it's incredibly topical, especially with this flurry of humours, whether they're singing hymns or a bit of rock. But they're springing up all over the world, and it is an amazing parallel. Paul, the Brighton launch was this past Thursday at Waterstones, and you're taking A Man Against a Background of Flames on your tour throughout the country in the next couple of months. Where can we catch you next in action?
Well, actually, tonight I'm going up to Newcastle to do a turn at Backwell's bookshop there. I don't think too many people from Brighton will be racing off to the station to make their way to Newcastle, but you never know. And then on Monday the 18th, the evening of Monday the 18th, we're in Oxford at the Albion Beatnik bookshop. And I think there's a possibility of several other bookshop events, but the only other one that's definite at the moment is 3rd of December, and that's at Sarum College Bookshop, which is in the cathedral close at Salisbury, which is actually a location that features quite prominently. Salisbury Cathedral and the close around it feature quite prominently in the story, so I'm very glad to be going to talk there.
We look forward to it. Well, thank you very much indeed for joining us today, Paul. It's been a pleasure.
My pleasure too. Thanks very much, Meredith.
So this is a brief report from Martin Nichols of Radio Free Brighton on the launch recently in Brighton at Waterstones of Paul Hoggart's novel A Man Against a Background of Flames. This took place on the 7th of November last week. And I was very pleased to have a discussion with Meredith Collins, who's an editor at Pighog, as we waited outside for people to turn up, on the challenges of editing the novel, if there were any bumping points, perhaps one could call them, when the editor, Meredith, felt she needed to discuss things with the author, in this case Paul Hoggart, who I find is Richard Hoggart's brother. Is it Richard Hoggart? Well, anyway, one of the Hoggarts. And I went upstairs and had a very lovely chat with the author himself, very personable, charming man, who told me that his jumping off point for the novel was to write a novel as unlike Dan Brown as possible. Fortuitously, it's reviewed in terms of Dan Brown by the Oxford Mail, which thinks very highly of it, as does the Morning Star, which called the novel a perfectly paced and savvy thriller which packs an emotional punch. I'm afraid I wasn't able to stay for the actual launch event. Apparently there was some music in the novel, and or some songs rather, which have been set to music, and that was played. And it was a very lovely, buzzy atmosphere in the coffee shop of Waterstones. Very mixed audience, and it seemed an incredibly civilised event generally. And so I'd like to thank Meredith for answering my questions, which were no doubt very silly ones, very intelligently, and Paul, the author himself, for being so pleasant and welcoming. So all I can say is next time you see that there's another Pighog Press launch event, I'd make a point of going to it, because it'll be very enjoyable and you might even learn something.
Each month, Pighog runs a poetry reading and open mic at Brighton's Red Roaster Coffee House in St James's Street. These events have been growing and growing over the last few years. Whether launching a Sussex series, or launching a poetry book on the night, or featuring a guest poet, each event is always packed wall-to-wall with poets and poetry enthusiasts. These poetry nights occur on the last Thursday of every month at the Red Roaster at 8 o'clock. However, this month, Pighog has an exciting pop-up poetry festival during the last week of November called Pig Baby. From the 26th to the 30th, Pighog will be hosting a variety of poetry launches and readings mixed in with film events, poetry open mic, party night. There's really a lot going on, and it's all happening the week of the 26th. So be sure to check out the Pighog website for tickets and information about the Pig Baby Poetry Festival. My next guest, Vanessa Gebbie, is a Welsh writer living in Sussex. She was the winner of the 2012 Troubadour International Poetry Competition and holds a plethora of awards for her poetry and short fiction. The Half-Life of Fathers features war poetry inspired by the life of her late father, a decorated World War II veteran, and by visits to various battlefields in the company of military historians. The collection brings to life the bravery of servicemen in this, Vanessa's first collection of poetry. Vanessa, thank you so much for coming onto the show today. The collection is a perfect way to commemorate this week, of course. So it builds terrifically on the influence of individuals in service and the lives each affect. Your poetry often stems from visits to battlefields and monuments around the country, creating poetry from places of such considerable loss. What was your process for this collection in terms of drawing on these historical places?
There's one place that I'd like to tell you about. A lot of people, when they go to the Western Front, visit a village called La Boisselle and an enormous crater called the Loch Na Garr Crater, which was formed by an explosion, a mine going off underneath the German lines on the 1st of July 1916. It is an awesome sight, and people are hugely moved when they see it. But most people get back in their buses or back in their cars and drive on to the next site. Well, at the bottom of the hill, at the junction of that road and the main road from Albert to Bapaume, there is a little triangle of land which is virgin battleground. It has not been touched since the end of the war. And it contains tunnels built not only by the French and the British, but by the Germans. It contains trench lines and the site of a farm, which was blown up. It really is the most extraordinary place.
Mm.
And there's a group of men, including the military historian who takes us across there, very dedicated professionals who are excavating that site. And I find that place extraordinarily moving. I've been lucky enough to go down a short way into some of the tunnels and to meet some of the men who are working there, all of whom are just incredibly emotionally engaged with what they're doing, as well as the sort of factual side of it. And it cannot help but give you that sense of absolute awe to be involved in something like that and to see it. It is visitable, by the way. It is called the La Boisselle Project, if anybody's interested.
It sounds enchanting to be in that atmosphere. And has that been a real inspiration for one of your poems in particular?
Well, in the collection, there are many that are influenced by the visits that I've made to that place. There are two specifically which are directly involved with that one. One is a long narrative poem about a gentleman called Ezekiel Parks, who was a miner, who needn't have enlisted. He was in a protected occupation, but he enlisted and he helped build our tunnels down there. And sadly for him, was caught in an explosion where a German mine went up and ours went up alongside it, and it caught a lot of men in the accident, if you can call it that. And he's still down there, and he won't be disturbed now, but they know that he's there. And I found his story particularly moving because by some administrative glitch, his name never appeared on any of the memorials, and he has no grave. And it's only in recent times, now that research has been done and it's been found that he's there, that his name has actually now been put on the big, wonderful memorial at Thiepval.
Mm. So he's receiving that acknowledgement then. That's wonderful.
Exactly.
Exactly. And you're going to read a poem for us today called The Euston Mob and Caroline.
I am.
Is there a story behind this one that you'd like to share?
Yes, absolutely. I'm responding in poetry with a colleague called Caroline Davis, who is a wonderful poet. And we meet up in London and we dig out the rolls of honour and the memorials. Literally dig out in some cases, because a lot of them are hidden away, especially the rolls of honour, those that are still there. I mean, some have actually disappeared when buildings were pulled down. Sometimes rolls of honour were just destroyed, which is desperately sad. But Anyway, the two of us are amassing a collection of poems in direct response to our feelings when we see these memorials or these rolls of honour. And it seems to be falling out this way, that she gets her inspiration from statues and I get mine from seeing the names, the long lists of names. But one came out by me, which was inspired by the rather lovely memorial outside Euston Station, which people probably walk past a million times if they're commuting. And I often wonder how many times do people actually really look and see and know what it is. And it's a huge obelisk with four statues at each corner. And it's in memory of the 3,719 men of the London and North Western Railway Company who died in the Great War. And there are four of them, and it's an intensely moving statue. They all are, these men with their heads bowed. And I just had the sense that there they were, waiting for Caroline to get off the train every time we meet, because we meet there.
Hmm. Oh, that's a wonderful story. We'd love to hear it.
Certainly. I'll read it now for you. The Euston Mob and Caroline. They wait for her outside the station, as they always do, heads bowed, eyes closed, as if they're asleep. She knows they are trying their best not to flinch each time a siren wails down Euston Road. She knows they were taught to stand on guard, ammo boots buffed until the leather looks wet with rain. She knows they marched here that last day through deadened streets, heads awash with last-minute orders not to faint, to stand at each corner of the catafalque, north, south, east, and west, to close their eyes not to see the approaching grey of loss of consciousness, to flex the knees, the toes, to stop the blood pooling in the lower extremities, to stop their legs growing heavy, as if they are turning to stone.
Thank you very much for that, Vanessa. That's wonderful to hear. As A Half Life of Fathers, presented by poet Vanessa Gebbie. Thank you so much for joining me, Vanessa.
And thank you for inviting me. It's been really lovely to be able to talk about one of my favourite subjects.
Thank you. The Half Life of Fathers is Vanessa's first poetry collection and will be launched in Brighton during the Pig Baby Poetry Festival on the 26th of November at the Red Roaster Coffee House. And that's doors for 7:45, starting at 8:15. So be sure to get tickets to see her reading live. If you're interested in hearing more poetry from award-winning poet Vanessa Gebbie, or thrilling insights into Paul Hoggart's A Man Against a Background of Flames, you can visit the Pighog website at pighog.co.uk or like Pighog on Facebook for more updates. The Pig Baby Poetry Festival will be running in Brighton at the Red Roaster Coffee House from the 26th of November until Saturday the 30th. As well as Vanessa launching her new collection during the festival, there will also be a reading from Kieran O'Driscoll, who's the Irish author of A Year's Midnight, and the launches of Kate White's award-winning pamphlet, The Old Madness, and Woman's Head as Jug by Brighton poet Jackie Wills. It doesn't stop there, though. Other Pig Baby events include a Belgian poetry night with a special screening at the Fishing Museum, and the final event of the week will be a celebration open mic at the on the 30th, sponsored by Langham Brewery. All you poetry fiends out there, log on to the Pighog website for more details. That's it for today's first ever Pighog radio show. See you next week for a Christmas special highlighting short stories that get teens reading.